The associated students of Brigham Young University have selected Florence Smith Jacobson to receive the Exemplary Womanhood Award for 1980. The two previous recipients of this award are Belle Spafford and Sister Camilla Kimball. Sister Jacobson has distinguished herself as an exemplary woman through many years of dedicated service as a church and civic leader. Having earned her bachelor's degree in home economics at the University of Utah, Sister Jacobson served for 11 years as the general president of the Young Women's Mutual Improvement Association. During that period, she developed expanded cultural programs, began the Young Artist Festival, co-established the Mormon Youth Symphony and Chorus, offered scholarships for outstanding literary excellence, and was influential in the production of outdoor theater presentations, which led to the restoration of the promised Valley Playhouse. Subsequent to her release as general president of the Young Women's Mutual Improvement Association, Sister Jacobson was called as the director of the Arts and Sites Division of the Historical Division of the Church in 1973. In this capacity, she developed many innovative programs, which have included the cataloging of church buildings, a joint art restoration project with Brigham Young University, as well as the restoration of many important sites in Mormon history. Amongst these are the Lion House, the Joseph Smith Home in Palmyra, the Brigham Young Forest Farmhouse in Salt Lake City, the Brigham Young and Jacob Hamblin Homes in St. George, and the Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff Homes in Nauvoo. As a civic leader, Sister Jacobson has served as a member of the National Council of Women since 1961. She was elected and served as the council's third vice president from 1975 to 1976. She served as the chairman of the Child and Family Committee from 1970 to 1974 and again from 1976 to 1977. She was an advisor to the executive committee of the International Council of Women and has subsequently served as a vice treasurer of the Financial Committee as well as a delegate to the International Women's Year Conference. Locally, Sister Jacobson has served on the Governor's Historic and Cultural Sites Review Committee, on the LDS Hospital Deseret Foundation Board of Directors, and has served on the BYU Advisory Committees for Family and Consumer Studies and Family Life. She has also worked with the PTA, the Cancer Society, the Red Cross, and the Deseret Gym Board of Directors. Others have acknowledged Sister Jacobson's outstanding contributions. In 1968, she received the Women of Conscience Award from the National Council of Women. She received the Exemplary Womanhood Award in 1974 from Merckx College, also the Distinguished Alumni Award from the University of Utah in 1974. Amongst all these accomplishments, Sister Jacobson would be the first to acknowledge that nothing is more important to her than the church and her family. This is clearly indicated in the talk she gave in 1972. She said, "That which people, especially women, seek as they cry for liberation is already in their midst. It is so close they do not see it, so simple they cannot understand it, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Those who tell women to rise up and be liberated and demand a new role in life are only advocating liberation from the very functions created in them by God that make them different from men. As I think of Latter-day Saint women, I think of them as being managers of households, holding public office, being teachers, having professions, being medical doctors and lawyers, driving automobiles, sharing in their husband's community property, and having equal rights with men. Many women have made great contributions in the fields of literature and art and in the sciences, and it is hard for me to feel sorry for us as a sex." Sister Jacobson is the granddaughter of the former LDS Church presidents Heber J. Grant and Joseph F. Smith, and is married to Theodore C. Jacobson, a Salt Lake City businessman. They have three sons. We welcome her husband, as well as two of her sons who are present. Sister Jacobson, will you come forward? It is clear why we have selected Sister Florence Jacobson as an exemplary woman, and why we have selected this Yadro figurine as the Exemplary Womanhood Award for 1980. The reason why I've selected that, Sister Jacobson, is because it is representative of the art to which you have dedicated so much of your life. It also represents all that is lovely and gracious in the life of a woman. Sister Jacobson, thank congratulations.
You. To be chosen to receive the prestigious exemplary womanhood award has caused me to evaluate why me. I know better than anyone else, except possibly the Lord and my husband and my family and my associates, my procrastinations and deficiencies, and the things that I know I can improve. But many years ago, in the presence of my father-in-law, I remember criticizing the appointment of a man to a high position who I thought was not worthy of the position. And I knew that he had some of these same feelings. But he said something to me which I have never forgotten. It was a great lesson to me. He said, "Well, Florence, it isn't what a man has been in the past or what he is at the present. It is what he may become that is important." And I presume that in today's world of equality, this stands true for women today. In receiving this honor, I'm grateful that there is a tomorrow in which I can work toward a being deserving of this great award, and I do thank you for it. I'm very humbled and overwhelmed to have been so chosen. The first news of this event reached me when I received a little memo on my desk after having been out of town from my secretary, which read, "The last week in January is BYU Women's Week. You have been chosen to receive the Exemplary Womanhood Award, and your award is to give a devotional address." She knows how I abhor giving public addresses. They're very difficult for me, and I agonize over them. And I have these many, many years. To decide what subject that would be of most interest to you is a difficult choice. I would like you to know of the women's movement and the history of it, and the inspiring experiences of Mormon women who have served as officers of the National Council of Women of the United States or as officers of the International Council of Women, involving 73 nations of the free world, or as delegates to the international conferences, or the unique experience I recently shared with Sister Belle Spafford in Bogota, Colombia, when we were asked to go and organize the American Regional Council of Women, composed of the National Councils of North, South, Central, and Western Americas. These are exhilarating assignments when we as women are able to influence worldwide issues affecting the home, the family, the United Nations policy, and international legislation. So many choices remind me of a little incident in my own home. Our youngest son had just returned from his mission in Japan, and he was getting ready to go out on a date. Two nights before, two of his very close friends had tragically been killed in an automobile accident caused by a drunken driver. And so, mother-like, I said to him, "Please drive carefully. Every car on the road is a potential accident, and you are responsible for your safety and the safety of this lovely girl whom you are taking out." And he looked at me for a minute as he was putting on his coat, and he came over and put his arm around me and gave me a little squeeze on my shoulders, and he said, "Well, Mother, okay, if you're afraid the way I'm going to drive, we'll park." He gave me no choice. I really also have no choice. For most of all, I want you to know of our Mormon cultural heritage, our roots. The early achievements of the church members are a visible testimony to the world of their faith and are another evidence that the gospel of Jesus Christ has indeed been restored. Their meticulous reverence for detail and excellence in such things as architecture, handmade pine furniture and woodwork, grain to resemble the beautiful hardwoods, hand-woven carpets and silk and linen and wool, and beautiful fabrics, coverlets, their music and art reached a degree of excellence that in comparison labels the similar products of the machine age of the 20th century as mediocre. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. And indeed, our ancestors did just that. Excellence in all things. I love the little verse of Sister Ruth May Fox that she penned in the front of her Treasures of Truth book. She wrote, "I dedicate this book to the past, the present, and the future. To the past because I came out of it. To the present because I live in it. And to the future because my children shall inherit it." And so it is with all of us. Our history and our cultural heritage are like families. They are forever, passed on from generation to generation. Personal records, journals, letters, receipts, art, and artifacts of each generation are important historically, not only to the past and the present, but for the future. It usually has been and still is the women, the mothers, and the grandmothers who revere and preserve our historical cultural heritage from generation to generation. Before the church was organized, Joseph Smith, instructed by heavenly beings, had scribes keep daily records. But it was from the little personal letters and diaries of the women we learn the details of their culture and their daily lives. It was revealed on the day the church was organized, "Behold, there shall be a record kept among you." And Brigham Young spoke of bringing the best of the world's art, artifacts, literature, and furniture to Zion to preserve them for the edification of future generations. In an epistle to the saints published in England in the Millennial Star in 1848, he said, and I quote, "If the saints will be diligent in these matters, we will soon have the best, the most useful, and attractive museum on earth," end of quote. We still do not have the museum, but I believe in prophecy. In 1973, when I was called by the First Presidency to direct the historic arts and sites for the church, the position, which was then called curator, had not been filled since 1919, when President Talmadge, who was the curator of the museum and also of the University of Utah, was released. He had as his secretary a young law student by the name of J. Reuben Clark, Jr. Well, when we came into this position, in reviewing the work which needed to be done that had not been done since 1919, we discovered that the only thing that had been done was in 1965, a young man had cataloged some of the church historical artifacts. In reviewing his catalog system, it became a total mystery to us. So we phoned him in Colorado and asked him what the H before the catalog number stood for and what the G stood for, because half of the numbers were H, really three quarters of the numbers were H and a quarter were G. And he explained that the G preceding the catalog number meant that it had been cataloged during the days of President Talmadge and stood for the good work he had done. and H stood for the heck of the mess they were in now. But he didn't use the word heck. My husband thought I shouldn't say the word, being an exemplary woman. Well, the mess after 7 years is almost cleaned up. Most of us have in our possession treasures we once used and owned, and our families once used and owned and have handed down to us. Such items are important historically and part of our family and church cultural heritage. For example, when my father passed away, we found hundreds of missionary farewell programs dating from 1913 up to the time that they had been discontinued. We found wedding invitations dating from 1902, and written on the invitation was the gift that had been sent, and stapled to it was the thank you note, or he had written a little notation, "No thank you received." We also found letters we had written to him as children, our report cards, and all of the marvelous childhood memorabilia which we hadn't saved, but mother and father had meticulously saved for us. We found our father's whole life there before us. And when my mother passed away at 94, among her papers were 61 years of handwritten personal letters in the handwriting of President Heber J. Grant, which none of us had ever seen, we didn't even know existed, and each one was a treasure. As many have done before us, the family gave all of mother and father's letters, historical books, and documents to the church archives. It was impossible to divide them among 7 living children without destroying the collection, and now each of us has a copy of the letters and documents, and the church has the original items. And I make a plea to all of you to write your personal history as our ancestors did, and preserve and treasure family art and artifacts of the past and the present. Someday, place them where they can be protected, preserved, and displayed for the edification of future generations, as were spoken the words of Brigham Young. When Brigham Young's words regarding a great museum are fulfilled, then the historical treasures of each generation will be on display to testify to members and non-members alike that the gospel of Jesus Christ has been restored and embraces all that is virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy. And many, upon seeing these things, will want to join us and become one of us. Now, I would like to visually share with you a small sampling of our unique family and cultural church heritage. The lights go off. If they will turn the lights off, then I will commence. This is a picture of Brigham Young with Mary Ann Angel and family, painted by William W. Major. The painting was begun in Nauvoo, Illinois in 1840 and completed in Salt Lake City in 1851. The background portrays a popular 19th century form of idealized surroundings. Major was an English convert and the first artist in the Salt Lake Valley, arriving in 1848. This is Joseph Smith. No. I guess they've mixed up my slides. This is the Handcart Pioneers by C.C.A. Christensen. The artist himself came across the plains with a handcart company in 1857 with his Norwegian bride. C.C.A. Christensen said, "History will preserve much, but art alone can make the narration of the suffering of the saints comprehensible for following generations." His prolific artistic works narrate graphically the persecution of the saints. This is a a portrait of Brigham Young by George Martin Ottinger. Ottinger was originally a sailor who traveled around the world before he joined the church. He then became fire chief after coming to Salt Lake City, and he was in the photography business with C.R. Savage. He established the Deseret Academy of Arts and was a fine portrait artist. Ah, now, Joseph Smith and Friends by William Major. And I would like you to know that left to right, they read Hiram Smith. From right to left. They've got them backwards. Right to left, Brigham Young. Let's see, how am I doing this? Yes, Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, Orson Hyde, Parley P. Pratt, Orson Pratt, Willard Richards, and Hiram Smith. This is a marvelous little painting of Nauvoo painted on tin, one we recently acquired and has been restored by Scott Haskins, the conservator for the new BYU Art Conservation Program. It was painted by Johann Schroeder. This is Mormon Pioneers by Minerva Tykert, who literally spent her life painting. She raised a large family and supported students of her community with funds from her paintings, many of them graduating from Brigham Young University. She painted Utah scenes, Book of Mormon history, New Testament illustrations, as well as murals in our temples. This is The Martyrdom by Gary Smith, a fine contemporary artist. The red color is symbolic of the sacrifice, and the artist has tilted the perspective, giving the effect of the room reeling with the impact of the gunshots. This is Joseph Smith receiving the gold plates. This artistic work of Max Rexler, a contemporary Brazilian artist, is made of inlaid wood. 10 different species of natural native Brazilian wood were used to create this design, and no artificial color has been added. This is an early view of Salt Lake City, supposed to be looking west, but they've got it in backwards. You can see the beehive and the lion house in the distance, and the home in the foreground is that of Daniel H. Wells. Girl and Hollyhocks by John Hafen, one of the most talented artists in Utah in the 19th century. The church sent him and several other Utah artists to the Julian Academy in Paris at art missions to improve their skills. Upon their return, their talents were used in painting temple murals. This is The Stonemason in bronze. Is the work of Mahan Rai McIntosh Young, artistic grandson of Brigham Young. This is one of four statues depicting the trades, the others being the shoveler, carpenter, and bricklayer, and this is the stonemason, all of which can be seen sculpted in granite on the west side of West High School in Salt Lake City, which was once a trade school. This is a beautiful painting by Everett Thorpe of the pioneers in Cache Valley. This painting came to our attention through one of our state historical arts correspondents who lives in the area. Historical arts correspondents have been appointed by state presidents throughout the United States and other parts of the world, and they find marvelous artistic treasures for us. This is Joseph's last view of Nauvoo as he left to go to Carthage, and is a gift to the church by the artist Harold Hopkinson. It portrays an emotional moment in history, Joseph never having seen Nauvoo again. Now, these few paintings are a broad sampling of the church's unique art collection, and I'd like you to see some family-oriented historical artifacts. This is a sample of a crazy quilt made of miscellaneous silks. A piece of silk in the corner has the words that it commemorates the Louisville Southern Railroad Company opening excursion. This is the Star of Bethlehem quilt, and it's a dictionary of calico cottons patterns of the 1870 period. It is made of 3,000 diamond-shaped pieces hand-stitched together. It was donated by Bernice Young Rogers, a daughter of Dr. Seymour B. Young, who was a nephew of Brigham Young. He maintained a hospital for the mentally ill, and he had the patients do handwork of many kinds, and this quilt was made by the patients of the hospital. These are the vests and pants of Hiram Smith, brought to the valley by his wife, Mary Fielding Smith, in 1848. Adult shoes could be worn on either foot. They were made in the ZCMI shoe factory in 1880, but they were more comfortable if you wore each shoe on the same foot each time you put it on and finally formed it to the shape of your foot. This is a cotton sunbonnet of the 1840 to 1870 period, and a set of 11 surgical instruments, and this is about the number they had in that day, in the early days of the valley. They belonged to Dr. Mary Helen Barker Bates, a Protestant, and she was Brigham Young's first woman physician surgeon in Salt Lake City, and she held classes for the women in obstetrics. This is a group of woodworking tools belonging to Christian Larson, a skilled carpenter who learned his trade after his military discharge from the service to the King of Denmark, where he was in charge of the King's stable. This was after he joined the church. This is a sacrament service with a common sacrament cup that was passed from person to person down the row and then refilled from the water pitcher. This is a very unique sacrament tray made by the servicemen of World War II on a battleship. The cups are made from 20-millimeter ammunition shells. A silk shawl made from Utah silk and donated by Catherine Young Platt. A corner of the same shawl shows meticulous weaving of the silk that was raised here and block printing design. This is the Kentucky or Pennsylvania long rifle, powder horn, and ammunition pouch, which belonged to Apostle David Patton and was used by him in the Battle of Crooked River in 1838 when Elder Patton was killed. And the pistol of Orrin Porter Rockwell, who was personal bodyguard to both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. He was always armed with the latest and the best weapons. This is a later one. This is a 36 caliber 1851 Colt Navy 6, so called because of the nautical scene engraved on the cylinder. Now the scars on the butt of the pistol indicate that when there were nails to drive, it was used for more than calming desperate characters. This is the drum of the Utah Militia, also known as the Nauvoo Legion. It was used during the Black Hawk War of 1867-68. And in front you will see Joseph Smith's sword. This is ingrain carpeting made in the Salt Lake Valley from wool raised in the Salt Lake Valley. The dyes were made from vegetable dyes, and a blind girl wove the carpet, recognizing the colors by tasting the different vegetable dyes of the wool. This is the hand-loomed wool ingrain carpeting pattern, which was copied by the Bigelow Company for the Lion House restoration. This cherry wood secretary, made by Brigham Young in Mendon, New York, was made before he joined the church. It was donated by the descendants of the family for whom it had been made. This pine secretary, hand-grained to resemble rosewood, was made by Edward McGregor Patterson, who was a farmer and carpenter of the United Order in Bear Lake County, and he made this himself. This pottery was made by Heber C. Kimball in Salt Lake Valley. He was a potter by trade. This odometer measured the distance from Salt Lake to the little Colorado settlements in Arizona and was patterned after the one made and used by the first company of pioneers. Besides hundreds of very special historical and family artifacts, we are blessed with an architectural heritage of excellence in the form of homes as well as religious structures. This is the Brigham Young Winter Home in St. George and the office adjacent to the home, which was also the telegraph office. Excuse me. This is the parlor of the Brigham Young home before the restoration when it was owned by the state of Utah. And the same parlor after restoration by the church. Another view of the corner of the parlor. This is Brigham Young's bedroom, and I'd like to call your attention to the coverlet. It was given to me by a woman I met on the airplane who fell in love with what I was doing and gave me her family heirloom. And this quilt was woven in 1834. I mean, this coverlet was woven in 1834. I still carry on a monthly correspondence with her, and she's coming this summer to visit me in Salt Lake. Another view of the same bedroom. The kitchen of the Brigham Young home in St. George. The dining room. Notice the beautiful Battenberg lace, handmade lace tablecloth. A steel engraving of the Salt Lake Temple on the wall of the Brigham Young home, and a picture of Joseph Smith also on the wall of Brigham Young home. Both of these pictures were listed in the inventory of furnishings after Brigham Young's death, and so they were replaced when we restored the home. The Lion House was a residence of Brigham Young adjacent to the Beehive House in Salt Lake City, and restoration was completed in 1968, and it is used as a social center. This is a view of the front parlor after the restoration, and a view of the same parlor showing the original pine couch, hand-grained to resemble rosewood. Only new upholstery has been added. This is the Lady Franklin stove in the corner of the front parlor, and this has a little history. It was given by Brigham Young to his son, Mahanri Maury Ankemer Young, as a wedding gift. He, in turn, later gave it to his son, the sculptor and artist, Mahanri McIntosh Young, who gave it to his friend, C. Clarence Nestlin, who took it to his summer home in Brighton, where it heated the family cabin for 50 years. The son of C. Clarence Nestlin gave it to the church when we were in the process of restoring the Lion House, and it is now in a most appropriate place there in the front parlor of the Lion House. This is a unique set of four chairs and a love seat, which were discovered by a young Mormon boy in a boys' camp in California. Upon seeing the furniture with its carved beehive decoration on the top of each piece, he told the camp directors they had Mormon furniture. They gave it to the church as a gift. It was refinished, reupholstered, and research indicates it was originally made for the council house in Salt Lake City. This is the exterior of the Jacob Hamlin home in Santa Clara and is an excellent example of pioneer construction built of local materials. Jacob Hamlin lived here 7 years. This is the kitchen of the Jacob Hamlin home. One of two bedrooms on the main floor. And the large loom, sleeping, and family room upstairs. It is a magnificent room, which is the size of the whole house all put together. This is the Joseph Smith and Lucy Mack Smith, Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack Smith home in Palmyra. From the autumn of 1825, they lived here until December 1828. Joseph Jr. and his other brothers and father assisted in building this home. Alvin died when the home was up to the square. This is the kitchen of the restored home and the keeping room, which was also used as a bedroom. While the family built this home, they lived in a log cabin nearby, and it was in that cabin where the angel Moroni appeared to the boy prophet in September 1823. 2 years later, they moved into this frame home. This is one of four upstairs bedrooms in the home. Now, this is the exterior view of the restored Peter Whitmer home, where the translation of the Book of Mormon was completed and the church was organized, will have been organized 150 years ago this coming April 6th. Notice the beautiful new chapel in the background, which also houses a visitor center. And this is our current restoration project. As you can see, this is the interior of the cabin in the process of restoration. And the stairway leading to the bedrooms upstairs. The bedroom, one of which, in which Oliver and Oliver Cowdery acted as scribe for Joseph Smith in completing the translation of the Book of Mormon. We feel it was this bedroom where the translation was completed. This house will be dedicated April 6th, this coming April 6th, as part of the sesquicentennial celebration. This is the St. George Tabernacle, built in 1863 and listed on the State and National Registers of Historic Places. This is one of the finest examples of the chapel builder's art. It was built as a public works program. This is one of two circular stairways leading to the gallery from the main entrance. And the beautiful Brigham City Tabernacle, built originally in 1865 and also listed on the National Register. It portrays one of the highest achievements in the history of LDS design. This building burned in 1896 and church members rebuilt it. It owes its beauty to the Gothic decorative emphasis. This is the exterior of the beautiful Bountiful Tabernacle, built in 1857. Also listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it is the oldest religious structure in continuous use since its construction. Every prophet of the church, except Joseph Smith, has spoken from its pulpit. This is the exterior of the beautiful Paris or Idaho Bear Lake State Tabernacle. It is Romanesque Revival in style and is one of the finest buildings produced by the second generation of Mormon architects and craftsmen. The interior, as you can see, is mostly of wood and is one of the finest in the church. Besides historic residence sites and religious structures, we are committed to collecting, saving, restoring, and preserving documents and diaries, letters, many of which have come to the church as gifts for members of the church. This shows a section of the archives with the collections in their protective cases and shelves filled with historical records. This is an early photograph, 1864, of Salt Lake City, one of a huge photographic collection which we are hoping to increase. This is the letter of John Taylor to his wife, Leonora. This is a letter written in both directions to save paper. This is Wilford Woodruff's journal, open to page June 8, 1844. Joseph Smith's personal diary. Patriarchal record, Joseph Smith Sr. And now, this is the original handwritten manuscript of the Book of Mormon. A copy of the original manuscript was made by Oliver Cowdery and was used by the printer one page at a time in setting the type for the Book of Mormon. The printer's copy is in the possession of the Reorganized Church. This is the original manuscript, as it was written by the scribes, translated by Joseph Smith, as the words fell from the prophet's mouth. This is an 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon and a 1940 edition. An 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. This is the title page. This is Delusions, the first anti-Mormon pamphlet printed. And this is Mormonism Unveiled by E.D. Howe, 1834, first anti-Mormon book published. The Morning and Evening Star, June 1832, Volume 1, Page 1, printed in Independence, Missouri. And the Millennial Star, Liverpool, England, 1840, Volume 1, Page 1. And the Nauvoo Expositor, June 7, 1844, an anti-Mormon paper published in Nauvoo. Joseph and Hiram were martyred 20 days after this edition of the Nauvoo Expositor was printed. Hymnals, one, an original 1835 edition compiled by Emma Smith in Kirtland, Ohio, and an 1844 edition. The Deseret News, 1850, Volume 1, Page 1. And then the Death Masks of Joseph and Hiram, made approximately 48 hours after death. This was a common practice for people of prominence of that day. This is Kirtland Currency, printed by the church. And Deseret Currency, made in the valley and widely used for many years, sometimes called white notes. Some of them were 25 cents, 50 cents, $2, $3, $5, and so on. This is a complete set of gold money minted in the valley from gold dust brought by miners and members of the Mormon Battalion from Sutter's Mill. $2.50, $5, $10, and $20 gold pieces minted different years with different designs on them. They're extremely valuable today. This, again, is a small sampling of a tremendous archival collection, which we hope members of the church will increase by placing their historical memorabilia where it can be preserved and restored by historians and displayed to the public. In closing, I hope this small glimpse of a few items that were part of the restoration of the gospel and which are the heritage of every family and every member of the church will inspire you to revere your family traditions and strive to fully live the principles of the gospel. I'm grateful for my personal heritage, for my parents who taught us as children the gospel by example. They left everything better than they found it. They taught us there is a law irrevocably decreed in heaven before the foundations of this world upon which all blessings are predicated. And if you would receive any blessing from God, it was by obedience to that law upon which it is predicated. In other words, there is no free lunch. You work for your blessings one day at a time, and they taught us we could not live off of the heritage or the accomplishments of our ancestors. We must be responsible for our own progress and success. Each day we should learn something new, serve others, love, and compassionately share all that we have. These family teachings are our heritage and our responsibility to pass on to the next generation. Now you are blessed to be able to build on the family foundation of a great cultural heritage. Only the gospel of Jesus Christ can inspire goals of achievement, excellence, and success as they have been established by those who traveled the road before you. The personal family heritage you develop and pass on can be the greatest the world has ever known. Now I know the world is in an uncertain situation today. But I want to leave this testimony with you, that I know that the Lord is in charge of this world, and that which is taking place under his direction. and that we have to do his work. He cannot come down and do it. And he is relying on us to carry out his work, to live his commandments, and set an example before the world, an exemplary example before the world, worthy of imitation. And that we may do this, I humbly pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.